This is Phil Ferrand, and I am driving home. It's Thursday today. Not coming in tomorrow. Thought I might be coming in on Friday there for a few minutes today. But I'm not. I'd already warned them, if I'm coming in tomorrow, I'm going to have funny t-shirt and crazy socks on. And skinny jeans, although I didn't tell them that part. Anyways, we had a meeting that I thought we had agreed was going to be on Monday, and then when I got the invitation, it was actually on Friday, and then it got moved to earlier on Friday, and I was resigned to going in, but then I got another email later on that said, oh, wait, that's not right, we're meeting on Monday, so, you know, hey, okay. Anyways, exciting week, this first week back, I mean, whew. You know, coming back, getting the left side of the brain restructured there and removing again. I mean, it was a good week. We got some good things done, made some good progress, a lot of fronts simultaneously, but we're just puttering along. It's good. I'm started now writing book 8, kind of mulling my way through book 8 and starting to write, seeing what's happening. So, just gonna see. I kind of have an idea of where we need to end book 8, so I know where I'm going, and I know some of the major things that's supposedly happening. I have a guy in front of me that is either having trouble keeping his car going or just likes to rev his engine. So I don't know which it is. So that's all seems to be going fine. I packed up all the beta books, got them sent on the 1st, which is the goal. So yay, that got done. I have all but about 2 beta books sent out at this point. So I've got 1 to send overseas and then 1 to send to a late last minute edition as a beta reader. So I'm going to get that put together probably tonight so that I can mail them tomorrow. All is well. You know, we'll see. We'll see what people think about this Windfall Virgins book. I did have 1 beta reader had already gotten through some of the more earthy parts of it, you know, and we had a little conversation today about it. And, you know, I told him my philosophy is, if we don't talk about this stuff, we're not going to be prepared for it. And so he seemed to agree with me. Whether he does or not, I don't know, but he seemed to agree with me. So, you know, maybe the book will be okay. We'll see. I haven't talked to any women who have read the book yet. But we'll see how that goes too. So this will be an interesting experiment. Anyways, so all is well there. I've been listening back and forth this week, and I think I last week listened to some TED Talks and that kind of stuff. A lot of really interesting stuff swirling around. I'm going to push this recorder back just a little bit because it's making me nervous the way it's just sitting out here on the end. You know, some really interesting stuff on a lot of fronts. And I actually had some holdover stuff from before. I think I mentioned at one point that I'd like to do a podcast on beauty and the importance of beauty. And on the fact that we have an assumption, you hear an assumption over and over when there are TED Talks on beauty, and the speaker usually states this assumption in terms of beauty is very important for a woman's self-image. And it's just stated as a fact that there should not need to be any justification or examination of that, that it's just the way it is. And I'd like to personally examine that a little bit and see what might be the potentials of why is that important. And I was intending to do that this week, but in listening to some of these TED Talks, there was one TED Talk that, because I'm writing this Windfall series right now, when I saw the title, I was like, ooh, I should listen to that. And it was pretty interesting. The title of the TED Talk was Fermi's Paradox, and in case you don't know, the reason there's so many TED Talks now is because there used to be just one TED Talk thing. You know, there was a TED Talk, and then it started branching out into mid-tech talks and tech TED Talks and those kind of things. And now there is, this is actually a TEDx talk. And so there are talks that are sponsored by universities that are not sponsored by TED, but TED provides them an umbrella. You can call them TEDx talks. TEDx talks. So that's a lot of these TED talks that I'm listening to now are actually TEDx talks. But these conferences seem to be growing by leaps and bounds. So there's a lot of material out there, which is fun. It's fun to hear other people's viewpoints and that sort of thing. So this particular TEDx talk by Matthew O'Dowd was called Fermi's Paradox and the Psychology of Galactic Empires. And I thought, ooh. Since I'm writing this Windfall book and there is a galactic empire in this book, I mean, it's a small galactic empire. It doesn't stretch for the entire galaxy. It only reaches out about 125 light years from Earth. But nonetheless, it is an empire of more than just one home world. There are hundreds and hundreds of home worlds, and there are tens of billions of inhabitants, blah, 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 blah. So I thought it was very interesting. Anyway, so he began this talk with saying that he wanted to talk about the future of humanity, and he specifically wanted to talk about that with some extremely new scientific results about the psychology of galactic empires. Now, that's a pretty tall order. When you say scientific results about the psychology of galactic empires, that's a little difficult because we don't have a whole lot of galactic empires that we can actually study. In fact, there are none. Unless you count Earth as a proto-galactic empire, and but there's still only one of them. So maybe you could make the claim with some extremely new scientific results about the psychology of a proto-galactic empire. But, you know, I'm always amazed at how we take the data that we want to take and then knock aside all of the other potential things that that might be telling us and then just decide what it tells us. And I found myself thinking that a couple of times in this talk, but there is some interesting stuff in here. So, you know, he went kind of back to the beginning and started talking about life on the Earth and the acceleration of our technology and all those sorts of things. And in his opinion, what caused all of this, he was talking about that there came a point in the development of humanity, according to his timeline, when humanity suddenly began to realize what was possible. They began to imagine. And in sharing those things with each other, and then those things feeding back and more and more and more and more, with the development of art and science, you know, that it all then began propagating, et cetera, et cetera. He said we spent, according to his theories of evolution, according to the theories of perhaps atheistic evolution, that we spent 200,000 years as hunter-gatherers. And the reason I say atheistic evolution is because when we say we mean humanity. And the question becomes, when did humanity actually rise? That's a whole other topic. Because there are these amazing changes in the DNA that occur that means that there are ancestors that after these changes were done are very similar to us, but we don't know that in fact at that point they started reflecting the type of intellect and insights and intuitions and all the things that we have. But that's a whole other topic. Anyways, 200,000 years, hunter-gatherers, you know, before this feedback then kicks in, puts us into this elbow of the exponential curve we're on now, where he said we find ourselves on the verge of taking command of our own genome and creating artificial intelligence, of understanding the very origins of the universe. So we're all on the verge of all these things, which we may or may not be, but, you know, there's another TED Talk that I'm going to talk about at some point in the near future about biomechanical engineering and what they're actually doing these days, and that's pretty amazing. And so out of all this, then, we realize that we as a society, we're getting ready to be able to reach out to the stars. We're getting ready to be. But then, of course, we look around and we say to ourselves, well, where is everybody else? Or as he put it, where is our example? Where is the they that came before us reaching down to a hand to show us the way to whatever that next transition is? And he said, this is a question that we've been asking ever since we thought it might be possible that there were others out there. He said, Arthur C. Clarke had a famous quote that said, there are two possibilities that exist. Either we are alone in the universe, or we are not. Okay, well, that's not very profound, but I love the way Arthur C. Clarke ended the quote. He said, either we are alone, or we are not. And both possibilities are equally as terrifying. That's fun. That's good. This guy went on to say, the author, he says, we've surveyed large chunks of the galaxy. Now, again, the language, we've surveyed large chunks of the galaxy with our Sloan Digital Sky Survey. He said, we've looked at more than 2.5 million stars. Well, you know, given that there's estimated 100 or 200 billion stars in our galaxy, wouldn't really call that a large chunk at only 2 million. But, you know, we've surveyed a bunch of them, at least in our ways. And, according to the science now, we've actually discovered planets around a whole bunch of them. Almost all of them have some kind of planetary system around them. And he went on to talk about the TRAPPIST system, where there appears to be 7 rocky planets orbiting it, and 2 or 3 of them are actually in the habitable zone, so there's a possibility they might have water, etc., etc., etc. And he said, we've now determined, well, we think, I don't know if we've determined, we've now determined that almost every star in the Milky Way has a planetary system, that there are billions of terrestrial so-called Earth-like planets with the potential to have life-loving liquid water. Okay, again, we're extrapolating, but there's probably a bunch. Now, whether or not they have water, that's something else, because you need very specific conditions, and we have no idea just how hard that is. However, the thrust, the philosophical thrust in discovering other worlds has always been that we are not unique. One of the things that's celebrated about Copernicus is that Copernicus set us on the road for us to understand that we are not unique, that we are just one of many. The creation does not revolve around us. We revolve around a sun slung off at the unfashionable west end of the Milky Way galaxy, as Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy says, which is a fun phrase. And this just propagates more in that vein. You know, the assumption is that if it's in the habitable zone, then, well, it must have water. The assumption is, well, if it has water, then, you know, it has life. What's interesting about all of this is that, in fact, there is new research that has come out, not just guessing that there are lots and lots of worlds out there that are at least similar to the size of our world and at least in approximately the same energy density zone as we are in from our sun. But in addition to that, there's also been parallel research that has established some pretty interesting stuff. I was just reading an article this week, and he mentions this in his TED Talk, that they've gone back and looked at some ancient rocks that are up to 4.1 billion years old, and they've found structures in these rocks, hematite formations, that look for all the world, as he says, like little hematite tubes built by bacteria in deep sea thermal vents. And these things are over 4 billion years old. And he said they are within a cosmic eye blink of the Earth forming. So this seems to indicate that life existed on this planet very shortly after the planet coalesced. Very shortly. And of course, that raises issues of how in the world did that happen? How did that get started? But setting that all aside, the optimistic thing that I'm pushing this back again, the recorder, I don't quite have this positioned right, and it's not cooperating. Sorry about the choice. You know, the optimistic among the atheistic humanists then will say, well, see, life just arises by itself. See, life is going to be everywhere. Because at this point, if you just look at the scientific endeavors, it does appear that there is a whole bunch of planets out there that are approximately the same as ours. In fact, there's enough that, okay, maybe some of them do have life. Maybe some of them do have water. And if you believe that it's possible for life just to spring up simultaneously, you know, just spring up just like planets coalesce, then it's just magic. Then you could say, yeah, there's a whole lot of stuff. And from the orientation of Copernicus, then that would mean that we aren't that unique. You know, we're just one of many. Herein lies the problem. Because we have been searching for decades now that if there's so many planets and so many possibilities that there's water and so many possibilities that there are life, where is everybody? Because we've been searching for radio waves, we've been searching for any sign of intelligent life out there. I'm backing into my garage. And there is nothing. It is silent. And this is the essence of Fermi's paradox. Said in 1950, the great physicist Enrico Fermi asked famously, where is everybody? And he says in his talk, the Fermi paradox is only more paradoxical today, knowing what we now know. So the Fermi paradox is about time scales. He said, our sun is about 5 billion years old, but the Milky Way galaxy is more than twice that age. There are countless stars just like our sun. So there should be countless solar systems, many of them with billions of years of leads on us. And wouldn't that mean that civilizations should have already developed and moved far, far past what we can do? And yet we have no indication. There's no footprints in any sort of energy signatures. So one way to explain this is that there is some kind of filter, that there is some kind of difficulty that civilizations have to get past, and that the vast majority of them do not get past that stage in the development. He said we might be unique and that somehow we've gotten through that already, but we just don't know. He said it's very possible that we have happened many times in the past, that a civilization has built some cities, has had a fledgling space program, throws a few nice conferences, and then bam, with stunning efficiency, in fact, a perfect deficiency wiped them all out. So, you know, he said, what can the answers be to this? And he said, well, perhaps that once you actually become this tremendous society and you engage in all this harmony, that you adopt some sort of first principle, some sort of prime directive that says anybody who hasn't made it there yet, well, we just don't talk to them and we mask all our signals so they can't see us. Maybe. Or maybe we get so interested in virtual realities that we all just retreat and we never have any interest in reaching out. That's a good possibility too, and certainly could be supported from what we're seeing. But of course, he kind of sets all that aside. Because he says, you know, within what we've learned in the past 10 years about all that, and in addition, what we are starting to see is he's convinced that whereas space travel, space exploration projects in the past have needed huge governments to be involved, we're seeing a new trend now of the individual. People like the Elon Musks of the world who decide, you know what, we're doing space travel. We're going out. We're doing this. He said, because if you can have people that have the sufficient billions of dollars, they can hire it out and get done what they want to get done. And of course, then he then assumes that other societies would face exactly the same thing. And then on the basis of all that, what he does is he comes to the conclusion, based on the number of planets that are out there, based on the number of ones that probably will have water, based on the number of ones that, according to his formula, should have life, based on what we see in our own society, that if they were actually out there, that some individuals in those society would have pushed forward and we would have detected life. Now that there's a lot of assumptions along the line, but let's just go that far with it. So he's saying, okay, because of all that, then he concludes, like others have concluded, and I've done TED Talks on this in the past, that in fact, the answer to Fermi's question is there is no one else out there, that no one else has made it through the gauntlet. And in fact, we are at the elbow and we are unique. Which is an interesting conclusion to come to after all of this moving around. And he, you know, he says, you know, it's a bit hard to escape that conclusion given the numbers. That's a little bit gloomy, he said, but I also think our exponential progress gives us some hope. If we're going to wipe ourselves out, we're going to have to do it quick because the clock is ticking. We only have a small number of generations to obliterate our civilization back to the Stone Age. Because, you know, we're already broadcasting stuff into the universe. But he thinks that there's a more cheery side to all of this. He said, I think the more probable solution to the Fermi's paradox, given the latest information about how we will proceed forward, or at least try to, is that the filter, though it exists, is behind us, and there's something special about humanity. Now, he says, don't get cocky. It could have been way back in the evolutionary tree. Maybe that chance fusion of proto-eucalypt something mitochondria to forge, blah, 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 like forged a complex cell. Or perhaps there's something, the wiring back to the African Homo sapiens that learned to think different. Yuval Harari said, he quotes Yuval Harari, whoever that is, would say that we learn to believe fictions, we learn to believe in things like a destiny and galactic empires and imagined futures, and it set our eyes first on the world and then outward to the stars. Okay, well, maybe. I think there's a whole bunch of assumptions that are getting strung together on this to get to that point. But the end of his point is that in all likelihood, in his opinion, were it. And what I find fascinating about all this is that while it was true back before Galileo's day that we were wrong to think that the universe actually revolved around us, and that if you paid enough attention and made enough observations, that became abundantly clear that the universe did not revolve around us. The whole thrust of Copernicus and the philosophy behind Copernicanism is that we aren't special. And yet now, unsurprisingly to me, we are turning back around and saying, you know what? Maybe we are the only ones out here. Of course, there's a whole bunch of assumptions to get to that claim. And maybe we just haven't developed the right imaging. But it's fascinating to me to see people who are atheistic humanists coming to the conclusion that we are just as special as most of the religions claim that we are. That we are beloved creations, that we exist in this special relationship to creation, that we are different. We are not animals. We are unique, blah, 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 blah. And so I just see this as just kind of one more step towards the embracing of the fact that there must be some sort of designing principle in the universe, which of course is one more step away from, does that designing principle actually belong to a designer, which is only one step away from, is that designer impassionate about what he has designed, or does he love and care and wish to be in contact and wish to communicate with his creation? It's fascinating to watch the progress. It's fascinating to watch this. And the talk actually, you know, gave me some more ammunition for the Windfall series, so it was good. And that's that. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.